Good morning, everyone. We're discussing the foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image, the foot period, that Roman iron mixed with clay. Now, if you recall yesterday, we saw how history clearly shows a continuation of Roman iron influence in the West from 476 all the way up to our day in 1985. But what about the East? What about the eastern leg of the Roman Empire? Well, as we stated yesterday, the eastern leg of the Roman Empire did not go into her foot period until 1453 A.D. It wasn't until 1453 that the eastern leg of the Roman Empire went into her foot period. But even though, brothers and sisters, the eastern leg of the Roman Empire came to an end in 1453, the Roman iron influence must continue on in that area of the world from 1453 A.D. all the way up to the time of the establishment of the kingdom. Why? Because the feet are composed of iron. And iron, as we have seen, is the metal which is clearly associated with Rome. So, the question, therefore, is this. Does Roman iron influence consistently and historically appear in the Eastern foot period? Will history bear it out? Well, the answer, brothers and sisters, is yes, and history will bear it out. Now, I realize this is quite small, and some of you in the back won't be able to read it, so I'll try to be as clear as possible. As we stated yesterday, before we can intelligently discuss the Eastern Roman Empire, there's one fact which we must get established in our minds, and it's this. The Eastern Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire are one in the same system. Anytime we hear the name Eastern Roman Empire or Byzantine Empire, these are two different names for the same identical empire. Okay, now what we're going to do now is look at a quote from a gentleman by the name of Obolensky, who has written a book entitled Russia's Byzantium Heritage. Now, in Mr. Obolensky's opening remarks, he's going to explain to us what exactly constituted the Eastern Roman Empire or the Byzantine Empire before going into that foot period. So Mr. Obolensky writes, and I quote, "A compound of Roman, Hellenistic, and Christian traditions. It can be described in terms of the geographical area over which its influence was once predominant. Originally limited to the territories of the Eastern Roman Empire, above all to the Balkans and Asia Minor, Byzantine civilization made a thrust northward into Russia shortly before most of Asia Minor was lost to Islam. The Balkans and Russia remained its main strongholds during the remaining part of the Middle Ages." End quote. So again, Mr. Obolensky has described for us what constituted the Eastern Roman Empire or the Byzantine Empire before going into this foot period. Now, in the next sentence, he's going to tell us what this Eastern Roman Empire was like after going into this foot period, namely the events from 1453 A.D. and on. Okay, continuing with Mr. Obolensky, quote, "Today, the area occupied by the heirs of Byzantium is basically the same, with the addition of the territories won for Orthodox Christianity by Russia's eastward expansion. It comprises the European lands inhabited by the Serbs, the Albanians, the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, and the Russians. The history of these six people reveals a striking similarity, which to some extent overshadows their ethnic and linguistic differences. They are united by a common membership of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and by the powerful influence exerted by Byzantium on their medieval culture." End quote. Now, we're going to continue with Obolensky from the same work, a different area of the work, where he zeroes in on Russia, Russia's participation or their part in this eastern leg of the Roman Empire and the eastern foot period. We continue. Quote, "Russia owes her religion and the greater part of her medieval culture to the Byzantine Empire, both directly and through her connections with Constantinople in the 9th and 10th centuries, and indirectly through Slavo-Byzantine schools of the 10th century Bulgaria. Byzantium brought to Russia five gifts: her religion, her law, her view of the world, her writing, and her art. Byzantine influence, which spread to Russia through the medium of Christianity and the channel of the upper class, was slow in filtering down to the other sections of society, but filter down it did. And over the course of the Middle Ages, it pervaded in varying degrees the whole of Russian society, from the prince to the peasant, leaving practically no aspect of Russian life untouched. We may conclude that Russia's parent civilization was the Byzantine culture of East Rome, in whose terms Russian history remains intelligible at least to the middle of the 15th century. End quote. And so we can see, brothers and sisters, that Russia is indeed an integral part of the eastern leg and the eastern foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Now, perhaps some of you are thinking, this all sounds reasonable, but did not the communist revolution of 1917 kind of take Russia out of the picture? Well, you might think so, and I used to think so until I saw this quote. And this particular quote at the bottom here is from a book which was published by the National Geographic Society in 1952 entitled The Root of Europe. And the author, I believe, shows that even today, Russia is still part of this foot period. Quote, "A Byzantine leaven has always conditioned Russian institutions even to the present day. It is still present in what is left of the church, and perhaps also in the Soviet Constitution. That curious blend of autonomous republics may reflect the Byzantine attitude toward minor nations, left free to use their own language and customs as long as they recognized the supreme Basileus and the professed faith." And professed the faith. Now listen to this. "The Russo-Byzantine idea of the Third Rome and of Russia's messianic mission is still very much alive. And the Byzantine student will readily recognize in the diplomatic and administrative methods of modern Russia features that were once familiar in the city of Constantinople." End quote. Just a little comment on the Third Rome. When Constantinople fell in 1453, guess what became known as the Third Rome? Anyone?
Moscow.
Absolutely. Moscow became known as the Third Rome. So, the eastern foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image, therefore, could be described as a religious political system made up of nations such as Eastern Europe, Greece, Turkey, and yes, even Russia. So, brothers and sisters, history does clearly show a continuation of Roman iron influence in the East from the commencement of the Eastern Foot Period in 1453 all the way up to our day in 1985. Now, we'd like to pause for just a moment to be sure we're all together on this. We're going to see how well you've been listening. Someone, please describe for us the Western Foot Period. Let me put this back up. Someone, please describe for us the Western Foot Period of Nebuchadnezzar's image as it appears in our day in 1985, based on the information which we've provided. Anyone? Someone, raise your hand. Don't be bashful. Okay. I'm sorry? Absolutely. Basically, the Western foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image as it appears in our day could be described, as our brother has stated, as a Western European papal system. Okay, now someone describe the Eastern foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image as it appears in our day in 1985. Anyone? Joe?
Russia and her eastern satellite.
Okay, exactly. The Eastern foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image could be described as Eastern Europe, Asia Minor, Turkey and Greece, and also Russia. So, brothers and sisters in Christ, here we are in 1985. We are in the foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image, east and west. Now, someone tell us, according to the prophecy of Daniel chapter 2, what happens next? Now, I realize that there are other prophecies that come to bear on this, particularly in the Apocalypse. But let's remember that Daniel is giving us the general outline of pertinent Gentile history from his day into the establishment of the kingdom. So again, here we are in the foot period in 1985. According to the prophecy of Daniel 2, what happens next? Anyone? Absolutely. The stone, the kingdom of God, the fifth world empire, the stone that smites the image in the feet. The stone, brothers and sisters, is represented in Daniel chapter 2 as destroying the image while in its foot period. And the interpretation of this stone is found in chapter 2 and verse 44. In the days of these kings, in the days of these kings, the foot period, east and west, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now, brethren, this is very important. This is something we need to burn into our brain. It is important for us to note that Nebuchadnezzar's image is destroyed while in its Roman iron foot period. The image is destroyed while in its Roman iron mixed with clay foot period. This will be the work of the multitudinous Christ, to destroy the systems represented in the foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image, east and west. And then that stone that smote the image in the feet, it will become a great mountain and then fill the whole earth, thus taking in the balance of the nations of the earth. And so, brothers and sisters, Daniel has now provided us with the first key to unlocking the identity of the beast system of the apocalypse, to unlocking the identity of that system which we as brothers and sisters of Christ must be separate from, because he has now provided us with that general outline of pertinent Gentile history from his day all the way up to the time of the establishment of the kingdom. But this key by itself won't really unlock the identity. It's going to take another key. And this, Lord willing, will we find in Daniel chapter 7. And we would ask that you please turn to Daniel chapter 7, verse 3. Now, earlier in the week, on Sunday morning, we asked that you please take a look at Daniel 7. We hope that you did so, because we do not wish to read it this morning. Okay. We have now seen how the prophet Daniel predicted the rise of four humanly governed world empires: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And we have also seen how this fourth and final world empire, the Roman Empire, was to continue in a divided state from its end in the west in 476 and in the east in 1453. Until the time when the God of heaven would set up that fifth world empire, the kingdom of God. Now, brothers and sisters, this lesson is also taught in Daniel chapter 7. In chapter 7, Daniel received a vision during the first year of Belshazzar. And it was primarily a repeat of Nebuchadnezzar's dream concerning these four world empires, but with much more detail, and we would add, from God's point of view rather than that of an earthly monarch. In Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar saw these world empires as a big, impressive, shining, majestic image reflecting all of the so-called glory of the kingdoms of men. However, in the prophecy of Daniel chapter 7, we get it from God's point of view. In God's view, they are nothing more, these four empires are nothing more than ravenous beasts, plain and simple. So, as we shall see, Lord willing, the two prophecies will correlate in the following manner. In Daniel 2, we saw that the first world empire, that's Babylon, was represented by a head of gold. The second, Medo-Persia, by breast and arms of silver. The third, Greece, by belly and thighs of brass. The fourth and final, by Rome, being the legs of iron. And we saw how the Roman Empire did subsequently go into the foot period, east and west. Now, as we shall see, Babylon in chapter 7 is depicted by a lion, Medo-Persia by a bear, Greece by a leopard, Rome by a terrible fourth beast. Okay, now in chapter 7 and verse 3, Daniel saw four beasts coming up out of the sea. The first beast was like a lion, and it had eagle's wings. As Daniel beheld this, he saw the wings plucked off, he saw the lion stand on its hind legs, and the man's heart was given unto it. The second beast that Daniel saw was like a bear, which raised itself up on one side. The bear had three ribs between its teeth, and Daniel heard a voice saying, "Arise and devour much flesh." The third beast that Daniel saw was like a leopard, and it had four heads, four wings, and dominion was given unto it. But the fourth beast that Daniel saw was so strange and so terrible that he couldn't think of any animal in the natural world to which he could liken it. It was exceedingly strong. It had iron teeth. Incidentally, this is in verses 7 and 8. It had iron teeth, 10 horns, a little horn, and brass claws. Everything in its path it either devoured or broke in pieces, and what was left it stamped to the ground. Even as Daniel watched, three of its horns were overthrown, and in their place a little horn came up, which was different from the others, in that it had eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now, while Daniel beheld this most unusual thing, a throne appeared with one seated upon it, styled the Ancient of Days. His garment was white as snow, and his hair like pure wool. His throne was like a throne of flame, and a stream of fire ran out before it. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands ministered unto him, and the judgments commenced. Then we are told in verses 10 and 11 that this terrible fourth beast was slain and burned. Then a being whom Daniel described like unto the Son of Man came forward and was brought to the Ancient of Days. And there was given to him everlasting dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all people should serve him. This we find in verses 13 and 14. Now, after seeing this vision, Daniel was troubled. He couldn't really comprehend what he saw. He couldn't really understand what it all meant. So he therefore asked one who stood by to please provide the interpretation. Well, Daniel was then told in verse 17 that these four beasts were actually representative of four kings or kingdoms which would arise out of the earth. Look at verse 17. These great beasts, which are four kings or kingdoms which shall arise out of the earth. Now, let's consider Babylon as a lion. Now, realize we've already been through this in the prophecy of chapter 2, so we're going to try to be as brief as we can. In what sense, brothers and sisters, could it be said that Babylon shall arise out of the earth? Have you ever thought about that? In what sense could it be said that Babylon shall, future tense, shall arise out of the earth? Indeed, when the prophecy of Daniel chapter 7 was received by Daniel in the first year of Belshazzar, the Babylonian Empire had already reached its zenith, and it was about to be superseded by Medo-Persia. So, right off the bat, we seem to have, a real big problem. But perhaps there is an answer. By taking a look at the original language of Scripture, this apparent difficulty can be removed. The word arise in verse 17 comes from the Chaldean form of the Hebrew word kum, and that's spelled Q-U-W-M. And according to Old Testament word studies by William Wilson, this word, kum, does not mean the beginning of existence. It does not mean the beginning of existence. Rather, it does mean to excite to action. So what is the verse in question really saying? Well, it's saying this. These great beasts, which are four kings or kingdoms, which shall be excited to action out of the earth. So, this being the case, we can see that the time had come for the Babylonian Empire to simply act, in accordance with the will of deity. So this being the case, the seeming difficulty has been removed. For the actions of Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon, were very significant in that they were preparatory to the destruction of the Babylonian Empire. While Nebuchadnezzar had finally acknowledged that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, Belshazzar, on the other hand, had lifted himself up against the Most High. His impiety brought ruin upon he, his family, and his Babylonian kingdom. This was, in fact, brethren, the very reason that an accusation was brought against Belshazzar on the very night in which Babylon was overtaken by Medo-Persia. Daniel declared in chapter 5 and verse 23, "The God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified." Speaking of Belshazzar, "hast thou not glorified?" Convicted of this, the Lord of heaven pronounced sentence upon him. "God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Thou art weighed in the balance and art found wanting. Thy kingdom, the Babylonian kingdom, is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians." The execution of the sentence was prompt. For in that very night was Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, slain, and the Medo-Persians took the kingdom. Now, granted, if this were the only evidence to support the identity of the lion beast as being Babylon, then another case might be made for another power which would arise, which would fulfill this prophecy of the lion beast. However, all we must do is carefully examine the scriptural account and compare it with the evidence of history to see that beyond doubt this lion power represents the Babylonian system. Now we'd like to take a look at a short excerpt from the writings of Brother Thomas, which appears in an exposition of Daniel. And what we're going to see is that Daniel was indeed painted a portrait, as it were, painted a portrait most descriptive of the Babylonian system. Brother Thomas writes, and I quote, "The beast being substituted for the metals of Nebuchadnezzar's image, they represent, of course, the same phases of the kingdoms of men." Now listen to this. "We learn from Jeremiah that the powers of Nineveh and Babylon were each represented by lions." He says, Israel is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven them away. First, the king of Assyria hath devoured him. And last, this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, hath broken his bones. Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 17. Brother Thomas continues, the Ninevite Assyrian was represented to Daniel as a lion with eagle's wings. Many years before, the deity had punished the king of Assyria and his land for scattering the 10 tribes by transferring the dominion over. Absolutely no doubt in our minds as to the identity of the lion power of chapter 7. It was plainly Babylon who, after being so described, went on to act its part in accordance with the will of deity and subsequent to the time of Daniel's vision. Now, historical records tell us that Babylon was overtaken by Medo-Persia in 539 B.C. And we would now like to very briefly consider Medo-Persia as a bear. Again, this is from the writings of Brother Thomas in an exposition of Daniel, which we would suggest to you, by the way, is absolutely unsurpassed in its clear elucidation of the prophecies of Daniel. Brother Thomas writes concerning the Medo-Persian phase, quote, "Arise and devour much flesh was the policy of its reign. The bear was the symbol of this government, whose dominion extended from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. The reign of the bear began under a Mede, and in 2 years passed by inheritance to Cyrus, a Persian. This change of position was represented to Daniel in the saying that it raised itself on one side, so that one side became higher than the other. Before it raised itself up, the higher side was no higher than the other. Therefore, the higher side acquired its position last, as appears in the history of the time. The ram in the eighth chapter," and this is the eighth chapter of Daniel, by the way, "the ram in the eighth chapter with horns of unequal height is another symbol for the same government. The unequal elevation of the sides of the bear and the differing altitude of the ram's horns are conditions representative of the same dynastic peculiarity. The higher horn came up last." Brother Thomas continues, "The bear had also another peculiarity worthy of note. It had three ribs between the mouth of it, between its teeth. These ribs represented the threefold division of its conquests. The interpretation is found elsewhere in these words of Daniel." And I'm sorry, I can't tell you offhand exactly where in Daniel this is. But it says, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes who should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was chief, that the princes might give account to them, and the king, the bear mouth, should have no damage. The three presidencies then of the silver dominion were the ribs in the mouth of the bear."
Daniel 6 and
1. Daniel 6 and 1 is where this particular quote is found concerning the three presidencies. And that ends, of course, the quote of Brother Thomas. Now, historical records again tell us that Medo-Persia was overtaken by Alexander the Great, in about the year 333 at the Battle of Issus. And we would now like to briefly consider Greece as a leopard. This third world empire, represented by a leopard with four wings and four heads, corresponds, of course, to the brass part of Nebuchadnezzar's image. And the details do indeed fit the Greek empire exactly. The body of the beast, this leopard, depicted the Grecian empire before it was divided. The four wings undoubtedly represented the lightning speed with which Alexander conquered the then known world, a task which I understand he accomplished in roughly 11 years, perhaps unprecedented. The four heads of the leopard, the four heads, represented the fourfold division of Alexander's Grecian empire after his death. As we stated, I believe it was yesterday, at the very zenith of Alexander's power, he died at the young age of 33. This was an event which threw the Grecian empire into some turmoil, as a long period of war ensued, which did in fact result in a fourfold division of his Grecian empire, each division under the leadership of one of his four generals. These four generals were, again, Seleucus, who, by the way, became the king of the north, Ptolemy, who became the king of the south, Cassander, and Lysimachus. Now, granted, immediately after the death of Alexander, there were originally five generals. I can never remember the name of the fifth. And he was the one that tried to maintain Alexander's realm, for the most part, intact. But he lost out, and that resulted in this fourfold division, each division, again, under the leadership of one of Alexander's four generals. Now, this finally brings us to a consideration of Daniel's fourth beast. Daniel's fourth beast. And we would ask that you please look at verse 19. Daniel chapter 7, verse 19. First of all, we notice that the fourth beast was very peculiar. In fact, brothers and sisters, it was so strange that Daniel inquired in verse 19, "I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld in the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. And the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom." And commencing in verse 23, Daniel was provided with the interpretation. Daniel was told that this fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom, the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. Now, brothers and sisters, what great kingdom is represented by this fourth terrible beast? Well, really, it shouldn't be too difficult to determine. For when it is properly understood that the prophecy of Nebuchadnezzar's image in Daniel chapter 2 provides us with that general outline of Gentile history from Daniel's time all the way up to the time of the establishment of the kingdom, then there can be absolutely no doubt that the four and only four humanly governed world empires represented in the image must correspond exactly to the four and only four humanly governed world empires represented by the four beasts of Daniel chapter 7. Therefore, having traced the history of these empires earlier, and now comparing this wonderful prophetic representation with it, the application becomes ever so obvious. Without question, brothers and sisters, the legions of Rome marched to world domination, and they did in fact become this fourth and final humanly governed world beast empire. Now, the fourth Roman beast is described as having iron teeth. Again, is this not the metal which corresponds clearly to Rome? The fourth Roman beast is also described as having 10 horns upon his head, and a little horn also. We note, too, that it had brass nails or brass claws. So what does it all mean? Well, first of all, from our earlier consideration of the prophecy of Nebuchadnezzar's image, specifically the Roman legs of iron, we can immediately conclude that the body of the beast, this fourth beast, represents the Roman Empire generally. However, if you recall, the Roman Empire went into her foot period in the west in 476 and in the east in 1453. Now, with this in mind, let's first consider the brass claws of this fourth Roman beast. Now, please listen carefully. This is very important. Considering the brass claws first of this fourth Roman beast, since brass is the metal clearly associated with the Grecian east of the image, if you recall in Nebuchadnezzar's image, brass represented what? The Grecian Empire, Greece being primarily an Eastern Empire. Okay, since brass is the metal clearly associated with the Grecian east of the image, and since Eastern Rome supplanted or took the place of the Grecian realm, then the brass claws of the fourth Roman beast must therefore signify or depict the same events as those indicated by the Eastern foot period. The Eastern foot period, namely the events in the East from 1453 and on. This being the case, the 10 horns upon the head of the Roman beast and the little horn that came up among them must therefore signify or depict the same events as those indicated by the Western foot period of Nebuchadnezzar's image, namely the events in the West from 476 AD, the commencement of the Western foot period, and on. And brothers and sisters, it is to the Western area of the Roman world that we would now like to concentrate our attention for the moment. If you'll recall, when the western leg of the Roman Empire came to an end in roughly 476, her territories were absorbed by 10 barbarian kingdoms. These kingdoms were again the Huns, the Vandals, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, the Gepids, the Lombards, the Franks, Suevi, Alans, and Bavarians. And indeed, brothers and sisters, these 10 kingdoms correspond exactly to the 10 horns atop the head of the fourth Roman beast. But what about this little horn? This little horn that came up among them. It is to this little horn that we would now like to concentrate our attention. Now in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 8, we find the entry of this little horn of the fourth Roman beast onto the scene or into the picture. And there are perhaps a few points that we'd like to make regarding its appearance. First of all, according to verse 24, we note that this little horn that came up among these 10 horns of Western Europe, the little horn was to arise after the 10 horn kingdoms were established. The verse says, "Another shall arise after them." Secondly, according to verse 8, this little horn was to have her territory in the same area as that occupied by the 10 horns. The verse states, "There came up among them another little horn." Thirdly, according to verse 24, this little horn was a horn, meaning simply it was a kingdom. The verse says, "And another shall arise," meaning, of course, another horn kingdom. And fourth, it was nevertheless a little horn, meaning quite simply that it was a little kingdom. And according to verse 24, it was diverse or different from the other 10 horns. Now, let's take a brief look at history and see just what power fits the description of this little horn that came up among these 10 horns. When the Western Roman Empire fell in 476 AD and went into her foot period, a certain power which had been growing in political clout for many, many years really began to come into her own. During the centuries between 476 and 756, papal power and influence was on the increase. As we stated yesterday, in 533, the Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian proclaimed the papacy to be the universal authority over Christendom, and he granted the papacy control over certain municipal and provisional governments in the western half of the Roman world. In 590 to 604 AD, Pope Gregory the Great expanded papal power and influence by boldly assuming the role of Emperor of the West. But if there is any date which marks the establishment of the papacy as a horn kingdom, it has to be 756 AD. And we're going to end today on this. 756 AD, when the Frankish king Pepin made what has become known as the Donation of Pepin. According to the words of William Langer, again the author of this Encyclopedia of World History, which we made reference to yesterday, the Donation of Pepin, quote, was a tacit recognition of the implicit claims of the popes to be heirs of the empire in Italy, and was the foundation of the papal states, and was the true beginning of the temporal power of the papacy, end quote. Tomorrow we'll talk just a little bit more about this little horn, and then, Lord willing, we will make the connection between Daniel chapters 2 and 7 and the Apocalypse.